housing.
As well.
You would think it's housing, and housing is a part of it. Childcare costs is an enormous part, especially affecting lower-income households, even with poorly paid childcare workers. So it's an issue that I've actually shown these slides with some friends from who do similar work in other countries, and they're like, "Well, we don't understand. Doesn't the city pay for childcare? You know." So it's just a different world in different places.
So if I could just add to this, there's a whole part of this discussion that's left out, which is a forward-looking demographic study showing what happens when you have zero retirement savings.
Right.
I mean, I see the demand on government services exploding nationally and locally.
Right. Yeah. So I'm more than happy, Rob, to give you more. You know, we have part of it also happens even that as they make more money, they go into a different tax bracket, and sometimes the taxes actually hurt in a more significant way than we would think. So this is where we start nerding out.
Do you break this out by age? Do you break this out by an age demo?
Yes.
Sure. I'd like to see that at some point.
Sure.
And I'd like to see the trend lines.
Well, see the
trend lines.
Yep.
I also made a note of how does age factor into our median household income by race, because, for instance, we know in Portland we have a high percentage of African American elders and youth, and young adults are leaving because of lack of opportunity. So not to be dismissive of this disparity, I think it's more complex, and age is an essential factor. So
yeah,
it would
definitely
be really interesting to me to get into that.
You know, one thing I can do is if any of you are interested, I'm happy to come individually, and you can ask all the questions you want, and we can run
cool.
and pull the data and have a deeper discussion. This map up here is related to what we were just talking about and focuses on housing affordability. And I'm going to go through a few maps over a few years. The blue dots on the map correspond to home sales during the year that were affordable to households that were making 100% of median family income. And then the orange dots represent houses that were sold that were unaffordable to buy for someone making 100%. So this is the map in 2000. You can see by 2007 what happened, so that's a pretty big change. That's at the peak of the market, sort of right before the recession. The inner neighborhoods were pretty much out of reach to an average household, but East Portland and some areas of North Portland and along Barber and Southwest were still affordable. Remarkably, and this shows that the numbers are more than just anecdote, when you go to 2010, there's more blue shows up again. So with the recession, we actually see housing become a little bit more affordable. But then you get to 2017, and that's where we are today. Only we think it's less than 10% of housing for sale in Portland was affordable to an average household. This example, again, is with home sales. We could do the same thing with rental rates around the city, so that might be interesting. But if you just go back, here's where we were 17 years ago, and here's where we are now.
Yeah, so I just want to underscore, this is at 100% AMI.
Yes, exactly. So, on a more positive note.
There's some confusion over by the citizen advisor. What's AMI? I'm sorry.
Average median income.
Oh, okay.
Or is it area?
I had said medium family income, which are slightly different, but it's the same. It's basically an average household within the city of Portland limits.
When we do affordable housing, we actually, 100% is sort of a big whoop for the council. Government housing would be 30% and below. Generally speaking, workforce 60 to 80, somewhere in that range. So 100 is pretty generous.
I'll try to be on a little more positive note here for a minute. Let me turn to education. We've had nearly a 20% increase in high school graduation rates since 2010, which is amazing. But, of course, it's not really as good as it seems when you break it out by race and ethnicity. Students of color, while improving significantly in the past 5 years, are not faring as well. We've seen huge strides, as you can see, the light blue to the dark blue bars there for everyone, all the students in Portland. Especially some big strides with Native American students, but still only about half are graduating. This is within 4 years. More students are turning to GEDs a little bit, which is a good thing. And so I want to update these numbers to include those who graduated within 5 years and include GEDs, because I think it's becoming an alternative for a lot of students.
I just sat through a 2-hour presentation on our high school graduation rate because it dropped, which was an anomaly because it had been going up.
Right.
But one of the things we did note, because we have so many students of English language learners, is our 5-year rate was way larger than any other school district in our area or in the state. So it's really important, since we have such a diverse population, a lot of immigrants, that I agree with you, the 5-year really should be considered.
Okay, that's good.
So I hate to be a wet blanket because this is fabulous. I don't know how this got put on the schedule for a grand total of 10 minutes, but we're now double that. So
I can do the rest of it in 2 or 3. How's that? Is that good?
Yeah, great.
Okay, so these are graduation rates. Some of this is repeats from what, or related to what Andrew was talking about. 42% of the people actually commute, when this is not all trips, but commute to work by transit, bike, walking, sharing a ride, or telecommuting, way above the national average, but that means 58% are still driving on their own. We tried to come up with an indicator for health. We talked to dozens of medical experts, and who agreed that weight was a great proxy for health, because being overweight is the clearest single indicator for diabetes and heart disease. No change there, but at least it's not getting worse. The next slide talks not just personal health, but the health of our planet, focused on carbon emissions, reduced by 21% since 1990. And we've done that at the same time, while jobs have gone up by 33% by 25%, and our population has gone up by 33%. So again, showing the environment and economy don't have to exactly be linked. One of the ways that we reduce emissions is by reducing the need to get in the car in the first place. We call this creating complete neighborhoods. We're now at 64% of people in complete neighborhoods. In terms of the environment, the two measures that are in the Portland plan is that we measure water quality and tree canopy. Both are doing pretty well. In terms of tree canopy, we've already met our 2035 tree canopy goal. Again, this is on average, so that means that there's still a lot of areas of the city that need more trees or green spaces. And the last two slides are around public safety. On the left side is my least favorite measure, because it's just done by survey and perception. And so the rest of these are based on things that we can count. And it's using the auditor's survey from last year, actually, which said that 60% of residents felt safe walking at night. On the right is data that shows serious crimes since 2009, similar to what Andrew showed you, and then again similar graphic around the longer trend line. And I think the longer trend line is really important. A lot of times we'll come here and tell you what's happened from 1 year to the next, and we say it's increased by 20%, but you're not looking over 10 or 20 or 30 years. And so what would be really interesting to me, if I worked in public safety and, you know, on data, would be what's the correlation between rising incomes and crime rates. We're becoming a little bit wealthier of a city than we were before. What's the impact of income inequality on crime? And so I know those are huge areas. I'm guessing there's people in the police bureau that are focused on those questions. And there's a report card. Happy to...
So I didn't see a slide for growing business, which is one of your 12 measures of success.
Growing?
You had it early. I thought it was early.
Oh, you know what it is? Good. I think the growing businesses measurement is exports. And I'm not sure how we left it out. So exports have been increasing, continuing to increase.
That's the sole measure of growing business?
We had the number of jobs.
Yeah, up and a down, yeah.
We have number of jobs and number of exports.
Okay.
Right. Is Tom?
Yeah. You go a couple of slides beyond.
Oh, you toss them in. Nope.
Okay.
Then what was the down number for?
No.
Okay. I'll get back to you. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sure.
Next up, Citywide Asset Manager. Oh, sorry. Yes, please.
Thank you so much. This is so good. I'm going to share with the board of Community Warehouse. I have a question and a comment. Comment is, as we move forward, Tom and Andrew, I promise you, I'm not let's not do any cut, but if we're talking about equity, and this seems to be a priority, and we're talking about the middle class, we're going to hear it, especially with Parks and Rec and the daycare potential cuts, the preschool. And the other thing is, if you do have an extended discussion about this with the commissioner, can we be invited?
Absolutely. Can we be invited?
Can we crash the party? That's it. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks. Sorry, I have one question. On the, when you say black, do you have any separation between black African-American versus immigrant Africans who are considered black?
I think we do, so I can pull that out for you. Sure. I'll send it to you.
Just because I'm an education nerd, is you will want to look at their time in school for the ones that are immigrants, because we often have students coming in at 16, and that does impact whether they're able to graduate. So it's kind of how long they've been here. I was really pleased to see our Somali graduation last year was a whole group, but they had been here multiple years that walked our stage this last year.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mayor, are we ready to move on to infrastructure conversation?
Yes, please.
Excellent. So every year we kick off these budget work sessions with a presentation from the Citywide Asset Managers Group, which is sponsored by the Planning and Development Directors, to really convey to Council the results of our Citywide Asset Report and discuss the status of these asset management and infrastructure in the city more generally. This is required by financial policy, and I think it's a really important context as we go into the rest of the conversations with our bureaus. And Tom's highlighted some of these in his presentation about OMF and really talking about asset management and how important it is to the city. I'm going to try and take the 25 or 30 minutes and condense it into 15 so we can move on to the auditor at noon, so I will be talking fast. But I think this whole issue, it's not just an issue for the city of Portland. It's a serious and growing issue at the state and the national level, and most cities are dealing with underfunded infrastructure. I'm going to talk at the end of this presentation about some of the progress Portland has made, because we really have taken some very concrete steps, whether it's increasing some of our reserve funds, whether it's the Build Portland initiative that the mayor put forward. We've taken some really important steps to make progress, and I think Portland has an opportunity to be an outlier, a positive outlier, in terms of how we deal with our infrastructure. We hear a lot out of D.C. about a potential infrastructure package. They have a hard time putting together even sort of an infrastructure week, and I think we can point back to the last couple of years of really significant progress with, I think, potentially on a path to a lot more in the near future. So the Citywide Asset Managers Group, I think most people know who they are, but just as a reminder here, the bureaus that participate, it's a cross-functional group of representatives from our infrastructure bureaus that help plan, manage, and maintain city assets. And the work is really critical to maintaining the city's long-term financial health resiliency and operations. In addition to this annual report on the state of the city's assets, the KMG also meets regularly to share best practices across bureaus, different approaches to responding to risk, resiliency, and other priorities. And they provide a venue for learning across disciplines and bureaus, technical assistance to the less developed asset management programs in the city, and really focused on that citywide approach to asset management. So I think they are a valuable group, and I think Tom and I have discussed ways to leverage that even further moving forward. So what are the assets we're talking about? The city owns and manages over $37.5 billion, with a B, in assets across water, transportation, BES, parks, and OMF, which represent generations of investment by Portlanders. And when I say generations, some of our assets literally are 100 years old, and we're still using them today. They're the foundation of the services that we provide to our residents. They're the roads that people take to and from work, the bike lanes and crosswalks that our kids use, the water that supports our beer industry, and we drink it in other ways too, but particularly in the beer industry, the parks where our citizens and residents play, and the precincts that support our police officers. And I think it's really important to make that connection that we talk about assets and can sometimes be a little bit dry, but these are what allow us to provide the services that are being provided to the public. So what is asset management? I'm gonna fly through this quickly. We have done it in the past, but just to remind everyone, asset management is the balance. It's balancing the triple constraints of risk, service level, and cost. And it's what asset managers do is they take this balance into account and they look at the entire life cycle of our infrastructure to help select the actions and investments that are going to provide those levels of service in the most cost-effective manner. And so focusing on each one of those briefly, when we talk about level of service, I love this because it takes just a second to look twice at this particular slide because it looks like the same bridge. And then you realize it's not the same bridge, because when we're talking about service levels, we're talking about not just being functional. And the bridge in the top, it's functional. You can drive a car across it. But it's deficient in a number of ways, and it doesn't meet the city's intended service levels. It's past its useful life. It's weight restricted. It doesn't meet seismic standards, and it fails to provide the safe access for cyclists and pedestrians that is a city value. And I think we really need to think about whether the assets are meeting those expectations, whether they're just being functional or whether they're actually meeting the expectations. You can see the bridge on the bottom then has been retrofitted. It has been fixed. It meets those seismic standards. It has the bike lanes. It has the pedestrian access. And it's providing a much higher level of service than the bridge on the top is. When we talk about risk, we're really talking about two different factors. We're talking about the consequence of asset failure, and we're talking about the likelihood that that asset will fail. And it's important to balance both of those things. Consequences of an asset failure can be something relatively minor, like a two-hour water shutoff. That's obviously important to the people who get it, but from a citywide perspective, it's not a huge impact. But it can also, asset failure can result in loss of life. And that's what our asset managers do, is sort of weigh those relative risks. And so, for example, when you're talking about water, a large water pipe that serves a hospital is far more critical than a smaller pipe that serves a neighborhood. Those critical pipes are going to require more inspection, maintenance, intervention than pipes with a lower consequence of failure. I think it's also important to note that where cost is prohibitive or a service level impact is acceptable, the risk of assets in poor condition can be mitigated by actually removing that asset from service. That can be an intentional decision, or it can be unintentional. And I think this is where, you know, it's worth pointing out. Parks let us know, and I don't know the timeline, but recently we've had 40 playgrounds taken out of service due to lead. That is a decline in the level of service that wasn't intentional, but it was through the failure to invest and the failure to sort of recognize the lead paint and go through and mitigate it. And a lot of those playgrounds are being put back into service, but again, it's being done in a more haphazard way rather than a planful way. And that is, you know, that is what happens with the underinvestment in our assets. And finally, when we talk about cost, you've seen this before, so I won't spend time on it, but it is important just to remind us that when we preserve our assets, when they're in good, fair or good condition, it is far cheaper than when they're in poor condition. And you can see this in terms of lane miles. It's a geometric line in terms of the overall cost. And so the longer we wait to invest in our infrastructure, the more expensive it gets to bring those assets back up to fair or good condition.
Commissioner Christian. So I'm not quite sure which slide you're on, but looking at the one with the gap, why is there a gap in environmental services?
The gap. let me give. Oh, go ahead.
I want to go and then I can answer that.
Why don't you ask it and then I'll give the overview?
Oh, so the gap in environmental services is identified in their system plan, and that's usually the case where the capacity of the pipe is not large enough to meet the intended service levels.
So when we get into the budget, we'll find out. I'm pretty sure that Commissioner Fish has a glide path to getting up to everything, right?
Yes, okay. Definitely.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, he does, and I think it's worth noting, sort of, with BES and water. Obviously, they have some of the smaller gaps that in terms of all bureaus, and then also there is a plan to get there. One of the reasons for that is because they are ratepayer funded, and I think having that conversation about making sure those rates are that they're as affordable as they can be, but that they're also meeting the needs. So what this shows is this slide shows the annualized funding gap, and what it says is that. The city would need to invest $310 million a year for the additional money for the next 10 years to meet current levels of service. So that's sort of the underinvestment that we have today. And this is compared to last year's gap, which was $288 million and $268 million the year before. Some of this is better definition as we go forward, but a lot of it is that lack of investment. Things continue to get more and more expensive every year we delay. Just briefly, in terms of definitions, the explanation of the categories, the RRR, this is repair, rehabilitation, replacement. This is additional funding that's necessary to repair or rehabilitate our existing assets to bring them up to current service levels or replace the assets that are considered obsolete. The mandate gap, this is the additional funding necessary to improve existing assets to meet regulatory requirements, exclusive of improvements that fall under that RRR or capacity. And so for an example here, this would be our ADA fixes. Is that right, Shannon? Falling into this mandate category. And then finally, capacity. This is the additional funding necessary to address existing inequities and deficiencies in our level of service for our current customers and citizens. And so our bureaus are getting more and more sophisticated in terms of breaking these down, this asset gap, into these various categories.
So on this annual funding gap, is CPI worked into this? Is that part of the growth of the gap?
Right.
Yes.
Could we get that broken out separately? I'm just curious to know what the real dollar gap is.
Sure.
Do you mean in terms of the growth?
The
back out inflation. I'm just curious to know.
Okay. Right. So how much
current dollars?
Okay.
The other question that comes to mind is, and maybe this gets to Tom's capital improvement plan. Has anybody ever actually worked out a plan in terms of what it would take to address this?
So that is actually some of the work that we have been working on in the last few years, and I'm really excited. Tom and I have been talking a lot about this to further that work. So starting 4 years ago, we put on the table some funding options, right, which was just really a start. I don't want to cast aspersions on the work that happened before, but for a long time we came to council every year and said, this problem is really bad. And council said, yeah, it's really bad. And then we moved on. What we started trying to do with the capital options funding report was begin to say, how do we make some incremental improvements? And we got some of those passed. Some of those, the capital set aside, parks bond. And I'll talk about a few of these on a slide later. And then the first really big step I think we've taken is Build Portland, right? That sort of moving from these small, we can invest a few million here and a few million there, to maybe we could invest $600 million over the next 20 years. But even if we are successful in investing $600 million, it's about 20% of the problem. And so how do we solve that other 80%? And I think that's the conversation that really needs to move forward.
How do you prioritize within that conversation? Yeah. All right, thanks.
Tom, do you have anything else to add?
No, I think you covered it well. Yeah. I think we need to bring you some options and also do some comparators to what cities face across the country. It's not like this gap doesn't exist in cities across the country, and people are managing it differently.
But it does take into, you said at the beginning, all more revenue. There's
right.
only so much we can do with efficiencies. We could put the whole general fund into this and still not really make
it. And we've done some of that. I mean, you look at the parks bond. It was not a huge bond, but, it was extremely helpful. And I think there are ways that we can look at some of those revenue options specifically for, for infrastructure.
Yeah. And I think during the recession, that wasn't the time to start looking at addressing that. But since then, our approach has been, let's just do what we can. if you look at the whole enormity of it and try to solve the whole thing at once, it's very tempting to just go away and not think about it.
Slide 9, this is a conceptual slide, but an important one. And what it illustrates is that our current levels of service that we're providing to our residents are higher than the level of investment we're making. And what this shows is just one example, and there's a lot of them, but this shows that if we don't increase that level of investment, the current service level will come down. And again, that happens when we close a community center because we don't have the capital to fix it, when a playground shuts down because of lead, when water pipes and sewer pipes break because we haven't invested in them. There are other options here, and I think, you know, one of those would be any of them, increasing the level of investment will keep that current service level higher. And that's really the conversation council needs to be having every year. Is that what is that level of investment we can afford? And then let's be realistic about the level of service that we can provide. But it's hopefully going to be, you know, somewhere in between here, right? That we're going to be able to increase that level of investment, but also be realistic about the level of service. And then the next slide really talks about the intergenerational equity, and we discussed this last year as well, but this gets back to that issue of the longer we take to invest, the higher the costs get, and so over time, if we keep our reinvestment at the same level, at a static level, that funding gap grows over time, and it really is our kids and the people who move here in the future who are going to have to be paying for what we didn't pay for now, because we're not keeping up that overall level of investment. I do want to talk about some wins, because I think it's important to talk about what we have done and the progress we've made, and things we should really be proud of. And so this slide tries to capture some of those. So City Council and Portland voters, they've made some of these incremental strides through the Parks Replacement Bond, $68 million passed in 2014. Which, as an example, has funded, you know, the renovation of Grant's outdoor pool. I don't think that would have been done absent the bond. That work is projected to be finished, I believe, around 2020, although that's still a preliminary date, but it's a time to start thinking about what's the next step after that. The Fixing Our Streets gas tax and heavy vehicle use tax, estimated at $74 million over 4 years, passed in 2016. 56% of that funding is for maintenance, and the remainder goes to safety work. That's going to expire in late 2020 as well. Funding the general fund capital set aside, where 50% of our one-time resources, both in the annual forecast for the budget and in the carryover in the fall bump, 50% goes for capital infrastructure projects. That's funded $61.1 million since 2015-16, which includes the $12.25 million anticipated in this budget process being set aside by financial policy for that. And finally, Build Portland, which at its core is a commitment to substantial reinvestment in our asset base, with an initial investment of $50 million, and we'll be coming back to council in just 2 weeks, maybe even less than that, to talk about that initial investment. And then with an overall goal of up to $600 million by using property taxes that are returning to the city over the next 20 years. In addition to these strides we've made with funding, with additional ongoing and one-time resources, there are strategies bureaus can implement to increase reinvestment in their asset base as well. Preventative maintenance is maintenance that's performed from time to time on assets to reduce the likelihood of failure and avoid the unexpected breakdowns and service disruptions. To the extent bureaus can prioritize more resources towards this preventative maintenance strategy to keep assets in good or fair condition from falling into poor condition, they can save money in the long run. There's the ability to implement life cycle cost analysis, and some bureaus are more sophisticated than others, but I think that's one thing the CAMG's doing, is trying to bring those best practices to all of our city bureaus, then implementing this life cycle cost analysis to provide sustainable levels of service. It's a tool that really takes into account all the alternative investment options. And a really good example of this was the decision council made around the life cycle cost analysis, comparing the different options for cryptosporidium treatment. The analysis gave council the ability to assess and anticipate future operations and maintenance costs and the capabilities of UV treatment versus filtration that I think helped inform council's overall decision to pursue filtration. And finally, improving cross-bureau capital planning and coordination to maximize the benefits of reinvestment in existing infrastructure and preserve those existing assets. And then this slide talks a little bit about some interdependencies, and Shannon, you want to just briefly hit on
one? Sure. So I just wanted to highlight for you an effort that did come out of CAMGE, which is the Resilient Infrastructure Planning Exercise. So staff from BES Planning and Sustainability and Emergency Management, with the support from PSU's Institution for Sustainable Solutions, organized a two-day workshop to begin to develop shared goals and understanding around long-term recovery and resilience. And so the idea for this originated from CAMGE and involved staff from several different city bureaus. And so these workshops, the group started discussions to identify implications of cascading failures between different types of assets across the city. So, for example, the group recognized that a failing pressurized water main could wash out and undermine critical emergency transportation routes. So the stars highlighted here on this chart are some of the areas where water lines and emergency routes cross. So it began the conversation to better think about how can we ensure that the water pipes underneath these critical assets roads are perhaps more resilient to facilitate evacuation if that needs to take place. So that's just one exciting thing that has come out of CAMGE over the next year, and a report is coming out on those two workshops.
So I have taken 4 minutes of the auditor's time, so I'll wrap up. But this last slide, we are not just data. We're not just data geeks. You want to go to the last slide? We actually care about people as well in the budget office. And so I actually just like this because, our future leaders are already playing in our parks, and I think it is incumbent on us. There's a real moral argument here that we need to hand, we need to hand our kids a financially sustainable city where we're paying for the services that we're currently using and leaving them a city that's in better condition in the future. With that, I will take any questions before we move on, if there are any.
Very good. Excellent presentation. Thank you. Madam Auditor, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners, Community Advisors, colleagues. This is the first budget request for the Auditor's Office since voters approved charter amendments a year ago that increased our independence. We have my... Yeah.
We already have it?
Yeah.
Yes, it is obvious.
There you go.
I'll wait 1 second while we get the slides up. There's only 5 of them, so. You got to go to the right drive. The removable drive. There you go.
There's no section for the auditor.
There you go. So this is the first budget request for the Auditor's Office since voters approved charter amendments a year ago that increased our independence. And charter now says that the auditor prepares a request, submits it directly to City Council, and Council evaluates it based on the auditor's priorities and duties rather than those set by the mayor. The auditor's duties generally fall into two areas, accountability and transparency. And the divisions on the left column conduct performance audits, investigate community member complaints, provide impartial hearings, and ensure lobbyists and political consultants disclose the parties they are trying to influence. The list on the right represents divisions and functions that ensure the city is transparent by making records and meetings readily accessible to the public. I'd like to call your attention to more information about each division that is in your notebook in the supplemental section. There is a substantial difference between our total requested budget and our operations budget. This graph reflects our base operating budget, which is $10.2 million. The total budget request for fiscal year 2018-19 for the auditor's office is just over $55 million. About 85% of the total request represents bond proceeds and other costs associated with the assessments, finance, and foreclosure division, operations of which are reflected by the gray bar, which is the third from the right. The division is self-supporting and not paid for by the general fund. The rest of the divisions are from the general fund. In dollar terms, archives and records management on the left is the largest division in the auditor's office, including $776,000 in bond debt for the building where it is located. Audit services and independent police review would be the largest divisions in dollar terms without that debt. The bulk of the auditor's budget pays for people. There are 55 full-time equivalent employees in my office, and the orange icons reflect the number of employees by division. And you'll see over the independent police review, it is the largest in terms of the number of employees with 14. My priorities for the coming fiscal year are to complete the implementation of procedures needed for our charter authorized responsibilities. The bulk of that work, which has been underway since last summer, is focused on human resources and procurement. A second priority is to increase the capacity for more accountability and transparency work by realigning positions and making limited duration positions permanent. My request for new resources to accomplish these priorities is modest. The first request is to use savings from lower personnel costs to hire a full-time entry-level auditor in audit services. There is an existing part-time principal position in the division, which was vacated when I promoted an employee to become the director. By combining that partial position with personnel savings, I can hire a full-time management auditor at no additional cost to the city. The auditor's office began moving to a shared service model for administrative support a couple of years ago because of budget cuts. In keeping with that change, a support position assigned solely to audit services will become a shared resource across divisions. This flexible capacity will also help with the new workload that followed the charter changes. In the fall budget adjustment, you approved two limited duration positions in independent police review to help meet its requirements in the Department of Justice settlement and increase workload related to code changes. As expected, I am requesting almost $265,000 in ongoing funding for these same positions. By coincidence, this addition aligns one of my priorities with the mayor's priority for improved police accountability. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have about my request.
Rob, could I just ask one question with regard to the audit services using personnel savings? Would that support the position on an ongoing basis, or would this have to be supported with general
funding?
Yes, fund
we'd support it on an ongoing basis.
Ongoing basis, thank you.
So with regard to the independent police review positions, that's an area of your performance measures that's not being met in terms of the target?
Correct.
Will these positions allow you to meet that target, do you think?
I hope so. That's what we're trying to do.
Thank you.
Have you finished your presentation?
Yes, I have.
Oh, okay, because I saw some other data sheets, but you've just given those to us for our information.
I have provided our performance measures. These are also available on our website.
Okay. So I'm just trying to understand, so that the charter changes that voters approved place us in the position now of you've requested $264,000 in new general fund support for IPR.
That's for independent police review. And that's because of the Department of Justice settlement, the requirements, the timelines that we have to meet. Also, you all approved code changes that brought more responsibility to internal affairs in the police bureau and to independent police review.
Mm-hmm. So our role under the charter reforms, though, is simply to approve or disapprove of that request. Is that right? And you presented a budget that reflects your priorities. So
correct.
Okay.
So the discussion that I had about the charter was that we have some increased responsibilities that came with the voter-approved charter changes a year ago. And so we're going to rely on resources that we already have inside the office to help us meet that increased workload. And that's separate and apart from the request for the independent police review. That request is being driven by the Department of Justice settlement and the code changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I can't help but ask, because nobody else seems to want to ask questions here, but you know, we had a very interesting council debate last week about open and accountable elections and where that would be housed in city government. And I think it was the feeling of every council member that it should be housed in the auditor's office, as opposed to the solution we ended up adopting, which is to place it under a commissioner in charge, which just, you know, as I said at the time, just doesn't look right for something, a function as important as independent and accountable elections, open and accountable elections. So I guess I'd like to ask you two questions. One is, I think we've all probably talked to you one-on-one about why you don't want it under your office, but I thought I'd give you a chance now to maybe express that to all of us and our listening audience. And then two, how would you feel about a charter amendment that would assign this to your office?
I don't think that program belongs in any elected official's office. So the same conflicts that you have are the conflicts that I have. So if I were to participate in that program, I would be directly supervising the people in that program who would be trying to run it. They may end up, as they will for whoever has it next, they could end up investigating their boss. I just think that there's a tremendous number of conflicts involved in that. So I think I speak for all of us that none of us think that it belongs in an elected official's office. I also have, from the very beginning of this conversation, and I repeat myself over and over and over again, I would personally have to manage that program. I have no capacity inside my office to take on something that complicated with that kind of high demand for services, and then it falls off in the off years. And so it's a huge management challenge to run that program, and I am not up to the task of doing right by that based on the policy that you all adopted.
There's a budget that exists for this function, I assume. I think we were talking about two FTEs. And so if it came with a corresponding budget...
Commissioner, that's not being proposed, though. I mean, I think the auditor's made it very clear she doesn't want to have it. I want the program to be set up by somebody who does want to have it. So that's why I have volunteered to do it. So I don't think it's fair to put the auditor on the spot. She's been very clear that she doesn't want it. She currently has the charter ability to say no, and that's something that we deal with.
Yeah, but I think our council debate last week, I think it was last week, I mean, just knocked short of the door of saying, bring forward a charter amendment, and I guess that's what I'm asking her about, because that's what I'm possibly thinking of working up.
Commissioner, I would suggest that there's an open question about whether two FTE are valid. That's a valid staffing level for that program. I mean, there's going to be complaints that have to be investigated. There's a tremendous number of data and database issues that are going to have to be coordinated with the county and the state. I think that there were two people in the prior program, which is different than the ones that's been adopted now. But I have talked to both of the people who worked in that program, and it was pretty much in a constant state of crisis. And one of those two people has left the auditor's office in part because of how stressful that requirement was for his job.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Well, I just have a different question regarding the additional $264,000. How much did you give back to the general? How much was your return to the general fund at the end of last year?
I do not know that off the top of my head.
So, and I know that the city budget office agreed not to analyze your request until it had gone into the council. That's something that I'd like some analysis on in terms of, can it be managed within existing resources?
So that's a fair question. You had asked for internal legal counsel, and
yes.
You've been given internal legal counsel. How has that changed your usage of the city's legal office?
I think it's changed it quite a bit because in some ways we were not getting legal advice, and now we are getting legal advice from the general counsel. And I don't think that in terms of demand on the city attorney's office that has changed much from what we were doing before because we had been going without. So if we have... It was really specific to the accountability division. So for audit services and independent police review and those kinds of divisions, we were going without legal services. But if for human resources or for the council clerk's office, we were using the city attorney's office for those
and
functions.
And how about for IPR? I remember we had a conversation about IPR.
Yes. About legal services?
Yes. Are you still using legal services for IPR?
Through our general counsel. So that position was created because it put our office at a disadvantage when the city attorney's office was trying to represent both the police bureau and the accountability function. And so that's why we were going without. So now we have good legal advice to rely on.
Because our conversation previously, if I remember it, was there was concern about using city attorney because that would be an inherent conflict. Do I remember that conversation correctly?
Yes, that's the way we view it.
And so has it been changed?
The conflict?
Yes.
Yes, because we have our own legal counsel now.
Okay, so there's now a wall between IPR and city legal counsel?
It depends on the subject. So for the Department of Justice settlement agreement, certainly that work is being conducted out of the city attorney's office because that's a city position. So if we have an independent question around a misconduct investigation or some other matter that would come up, then we are using our general counsel for those kinds of things.
Very good. Great. And I'm interested in the conversation Dan wants to have. I don't want to have it right here in the budget hearing, but that is a conversation I'd like to take up. Rob, you always have
Mayor.
A question. Nothing?
Yeah, I don't want to wade into this one.
Okay. You're a smart man. You always were. Who was asked? Oh, Tom.
Just Mayor, for the record, I would like my staff to be involved in that conversation as well. Going forward.
What conversation are we talking about?
The conversation that Commissioner Saltzman's raising about open, accountable elections. I'm happy to help with some advice.
As the commissioner in charge of the program now, I'm not interested in having that conversation right now. We really need to focus on getting it going.
That's what I'm talking about. Support and implementation.
If
there's a support function we can provide and any advice we can provide, we're happy to help. That's all I'm trying to
do. Increased independence and what she's now working on to get her bureau the way she wants it with us, focusing on getting the program implemented by next year, I don't have the capacity to have that discussion, the long-term discussion right now. And besides which, once we get it going, we'll know whether the two positions is enough or not.
But if we don't have the long-term conversation, it becomes a short-term conversation for somebody else down the road. So I'd like to have that conversation.
Okay.
And I will.
Fair enough.
What else?
I'm finished if you're finished.
I'm always finished.
Okay.
I live finished. Any other questions? Thank you. We are adjourned.
I was hoping
there was the
budget mapping, and we're not due to be done until 12:30.
Did I miss something?
No, it was just getting back to the budget mapping. Thank you for that. There may be some time. Claudia and I have been emailing in a future work session, to sort of loop back to that.
Okay, because East Portland's very interested in this topic, and I'd like to compliment you on it, but I also would
Great.
Be very interested
Let me work with the mayor and his staff on when we can work that into the schedule.
Okay.
Great. I'd enjoy that, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
program. I had lots of experience with Community Warehouse last week.
Were they good? Did they take care of you?
Oh, yeah. I had a sofa. I'm not a calling device.
Yes. I have board members that said, you guys did too much work on, you know, taking care of your people. Well, I'm glad he was.
Yeah, good. Very good experience.
Yes. I have a crazy question. Have we ever considered to have a government signal in the person, like, you know, the whole very...
We have a consultant
Kristen, can I just this stuff here? I'm going to go run across the street and get my lunch because I have a 1 o'clock meeting. Just leave. Don't. You may take those, but don't take. That's not. This isn't your responsibility. Okay. Thank you.
I had no plans to take it, but I'm really clear about it now.
He doesn't like people cleaning up after.
Oh man.
So.
This is a crazy idea.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yes.